You're tuning in to the Black Hollywood Live Network, featuring news, interviews, and commentary on all things Black Hollywood. Hollywood redefined. From Los Angeles, California, presented by Maria Menounos and streaming live thanks to Akamai Technologies. This is Black Hollywood Live. Next, featuring intimate and in-depth interviews with Black Hollywood's next edition of stars and influencers. Black Hollywood Live. Hollywood redefined.
You're listening to Black Hollywood Live.
And now, the host for Black Hollywood Live, next.
Welcome, welcome, welcome to Black Hollywood Live's Next, where we keep you posted on what is hot and new in Black Hollywood. I'm your host, Ebony K. Williams, your resident legal scholar, joined by Miss Jessica King, producer at Dish Nation, and our comedic extraordinaire, Mr. Nick Perdue.
What's up?
So welcome live to the studio this afternoon. We are joined by a young man who is probably on the hottest, I mean, I have to say it, the hottest new show for the season. I'm talking about Robert Christopher Riley, ladies and gentlemen.
Thank you.
Star VH1's Hit the Floor.
I appreciate that. Apparently I'm hot and new since I'm on this show.
Since you're on.
There you go.
By definition.
I will take it. Please and thank you.
Excellent. All right, we're going to get into it, Rob. We know that you are a first-generation American.
I am.
Yes, and that you raised in Brooklyn, but culturally, your background, at least on your mother's side, Trinidadian.
Absolutely.
Give us some cultural highlights from the island.
Well, Trinidad's the southernmost island in the Caribbean. We are the originators of calypso and soca music and the steel drum. We've got the second biggest carnival in the world, second only to Brazil.
Right.
It's a very fun and vibrant nation. You start dancing from the time you're in your mother's womb for the most part. We like spicy food. We can be relatively provocative, but the nation is, the country is very, very respectful. It's pretty Christian and probably more English Catholic since it was an English colony right before it got its independence.
Sure.
But it's fun, man. It's definitely different. I embrace the fact that I'm from Trinidad, that mm-hmm. I'm from the Caribbean, as opposed to just being from America. It's nice to have a little additional culture, a little spice. Yes, girl, a little spice.
I love it.
We like to keep things hot.
Speaking of the spice, does the spice ever come in handy with your acting?
I haven't had to delve deep into that yet. It does help because, like I said, I was able to dance before I ever took any type of formal dance training. So that usually surprises people when they're like, wow, that guy can move. He's 6'2" and 200 pounds. I wouldn't think he can move like that.
That's funny.
it hasn't come into play yet. The only Caribbean thing I've ever auditioned for as a voiceover I did not get because apparently I wasn't Caribbean enough. So.
Well, remains to be seen.
You can work on that.
Right.
I know, right?
Cool.
Well, you've mentioned in past interviews that you were raised by your mom and your grandma.
Yes.
And that your dad wasn't really involved in your upbringing.
Not at all.
So has your single parent upbringing influenced your ideas of your future and raising a family of your own?
Oh, yeah. I don't have any baby mamas. That's how it's influenced.
What about the two
that.
Outside, though? What about those?
Oh, no. They just came for the ride.
Okay.
Yeah. Those aren't my kids either. It's because I was raised by just my mother and my grandmother. I've been, maybe a little bit more careful to make sure that doesn't happen because I don't want to put a child through what I went through. It was great. My mother is super mom. She raised myself mm-hmm. and my brother. My grandmother didn't work. She came over here when she was 70 years old mm-hmm. After my mother left my father. And so she supported the four of us by working at the New York Stock Exchange mm-hmm. Until wow. she retired. And, I basically do a lot of what I do to make sure that she's proud. Mm-hmm. One of the best moments I had was bringing her out here to the last day of filming for me on Hit the Floor. Mm-hmm. And she got a chance to see what I do for television because she's seen me on Broadway and, mm-hmm. and whatnot. But it was really nice, and a lot of people paid her a lot of compliments. So being raised by just my mother and my grandmother has definitely taught me a certain level of respect for women. And mm-hmm. I try to carry myself in no way that would embarrass my mother.
Well, we're going to pay her another compliment right now. Robert Riley's mom, you did a fantastic job.
See that, Mom?
That's for you.
Now, let me ask you, Robert, as a son and grandson of immigrants,
yes.
Okay, I mean, do you feel like that there's added pressure, you know, that you really have to succeed in Hollywood since, you know, getting these opportunities that you wouldn't have gotten in Trinidad?
Well, yeah, I mean, I had to succeed, period. My mother never wanted me to be an actor. She actually was very against it when I first started dabbling with it in college. I went to Lehigh University to be an accountant and a football player. I found the acting thing, she wasn't necessarily supportive of that, because with all the sacrifices that you make moving here from another country, you want your child to be successful. Yeah. And let's face it, entertainment's not necessarily any guaranteed success. So you go to school, you're an accountant, you get your degree, you get a job, and you keep it moving. Mm-hmm. So luckily, I when I rolled the dice, you know, some things happened relatively quickly that proved to her that I was capable of mm-hmm. of making it, so to speak, in the business. But in short, you're absolutely right. There's definitely a little bit of added pressure because, you know, I feel like the sacrifices that my family made in order for me to be where I am are very, very, very great. And yeah. I just got to hold up my end of the bargain.
You know, it's true.
So far, so good.
Well, you're from Brooklyn.
Yeah,
for those who have not noticed, your beautiful hat is on display for the world to know.
Oh, really?
Right. Caking with Brooklyn.
Yeah. Oh, it's okay. There's other important things on the hat.
Oh, nice.
Oh, there you go.
Hashtag hit the floor.
Represent.
You like that, Nick.
Well played, Robert. Well played.
I see you.
Now, I know from personal experience, a lot of New Yorkers do not like California. They say they hate the seasons, they hate the food, the personalities, whatnot. How has your California experience been, and what are your thoughts about California versus New York?
Well, this is the second time that I've lived in California. I lived here in 2009 for 10 months before I went back home to do another show on Broadway, and I did not like it very much then. I hadn't found my niche yet, and it's like that with any new city. I've lived in many different places around the country for extended periods of time. This time around, having a lot more fun. Drive a convertible now, so that helps. That helps.
That makes all the difference.
It does. You know, you get to enjoy the weather even when you're in your car and miserable, unless it's 100 degrees and the sun's up. at noon, then you might want to put that top up. But I enjoy it. I'm a pretty fit person, so I love the fact that I've got, you know, fresh produce all over the place. Shout out to the Mexicans. I appreciate that. We know that y'all are picking the fruits and vegetables. Nobody else is going to get credit for that. So they feed me. I really love my Mexican folks. I like LA a lot more than I did last time. I'm having a good time here. I'm from Brooklyn. I love New York. You'll never get me to choose sides and be like, oh, I live in LA now. It's been 35 mm-hmm. years. I'm like, that's cool, but I still lived in New York for 30. It's cool. I can dig it, you know. It's a nice place to hang out for a minute. You know, having a job doesn't hurt either.
Right. I was going to say, it's a nice place to be in a number one show. Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Now, come on. Can I sit up here and complain? Like, I hate Los Angeles. Right. People are like, you want to... No, I can't do that.
Right.
No, so. I'm not that dude.
That's cool. So, as you stated earlier, you completed your bachelor's degree from Lehigh University.
Shout out to Lehigh.
A very quaint but little-known gem, like academically. Almost, they call it like a hidden ivy.
That's right. We're like the baby Ivy League.
Yeah. It's a very, very well-respected university. You completed your degree in theater, but like you said, you started as an accounting major. Yeah. Can you walk us through that transition? How does an accounting major graduate as a theater major?
Okay, this is a very interesting story. It's interesting to me since I tell it all the time. I was an accountant, and after my second semester freshman year, I got the chance to pick my own classes because I was a football player the first semester, and they choose your classes for you. Huh. So I took an intro to acting class. Lehigh, at the time I was there, I believe was 90+% white.
Right.
In this intro to acting class, or in the theater department, they were performing A Raisin in the Sun, or putting on A Raisin in the Sun that spring semester. The majority of that cast is African American, so they needed to find some more African American actors. I was in the class. It was taught by Cashy Johnson, an African American woman who was also an alum from Lehigh, and she was there as an associate professor in her first year. They asked me to audition. I said no, many times because I was an accountant and a football player. I don't get on stage and prance around, blah, blah, blah. sooner or later, probably about the fifth or sixth time I walked into class and they said, we really need you to audition for it. There's a chance that we might not have enough people and blah, blah, blah. So I began to feel a little bit of an obligation. Oh, not a little bit. I felt an obligation to the community there, the minority community at Lehigh, that if I didn't do this thing, if I didn't try, I couldn't complain for the next 4 years about them not doing anything. Mm-hmm. You know, like, oh, we don't have any black things on campus. It's like, well, we gave you one and you didn't do it. So there, you know, so I went out and I auditioned for it. I got a call back. Didn't even know what that was, but I went I went to it. And they asked me to, you know, they said next day, go to the board and, you know, you'll see if your name's cast. And I went up there and my name was right.
Okay, stop, pause. Yeah. In that moment, although you were very reluctant to audition, you had to basically be begged. Were you excited to go see if your name was on the board?
I think I might have been more worried. I'll be honest with you. Like, I've never been asked that question, but thinking back to that moment, there was never a point like I've auditioned for. I mean, I've obviously at this point I've auditioned for things. I've tried out for teams. I've you know. Taking tests for specialized schools, and I'm always like, yeah, you know, I gotta go take, let me see where I'm at. Boom, my name, I got that. But this time I was just kind of like, man, if my name is on this board, this is.
This is the beginning of.
So I go up there, and sure enough, I look on the board, and my name's right there, and I'm like, all right, well, I'm in the show. Okay, obviously, I like making people laugh, so I can do that. And then it said Walter Lee. And for those of you who don't know, Walter Lee is the lead male character in the show. And I promptly went into Cashy's office and I said, I think you guys have made a great mistake. I really appreciate it, but I am not going to be able to do this. I was 18 years old. Walter Lee's like 35. He has a child. He's going through all these things. I'm like, I don't even know what I want to do tomorrow. Like, how am I supposed to be? But Cashy took me under her wing and said, don't worry about it. You're more talented than you could ever imagine. I'll have you back. I'm in the show with you. She was playing Mama, and she sure did. And if it wasn't for her, if it wasn't for her, I wouldn't be doing what I'm doing right now.
Wow! So, shout out to Cammy.
Yeah, I got lucky, Cashy Johnson. You know.
Awesome. Well, while you're at Lehigh, you created a mascot. Tell us the story. I'm dying to hear it.
Wave Man. All right. Well, I'm big on school spirit. I love sports. I love home field advantage. And Lehigh is a very white collar school. Most of the families there are of affluent backgrounds, which tend to be relatively reserved at sporting events.
It's wine and cheese crowds, as they call them.
Wine and cheese. Wine
That's
and
what
cheese.
They call them.
Well, let Golf me clap for Texas.
Yeah, exactly. Good job. My sophomore year, once I stopped playing football, I was working in the sports marketing department. They said, hey, Rob, do you know, we need somebody else to be the mascot. Would you, like, be in our mascot uniform? And I was like, okay. I always wanted to do that. I thought those guys were fun. So we were the Mountain Hawks, and that bird doesn't even exist, but it doesn't matter. So I'm, like, in this brown bird costume with, like, a golden beak, and things are hilarious. I'm having a blast. Okay. But I split time with this other guy. This other guy was a little bit more rambunctious than I was. And one day we went down to Princeton, and him and the Princeton Tiger got into an altercation. So the two mascots come to fisticuffs. Now I'm there in my, like, wearing my Lehigh sweats and like a wife beater or something, helping out the like cheerleaders, get everybody excited because I'm waiting to do my turn in the second half. Okay. Well, now the mascot gets suspended. So there is no mascot for the second half. So at that moment, I'm like, all right, well, I got to do something since I'm here. I'm getting paid, whatever. So I'm going to, I took like ribbons out of the cheerleader's hair and tied them around my arms, a la the Ultimate Warrior from the WWF, now the WWE, my favorite wrestler. There was a little sign, and the sign said, do the wave. You know, the cheerleader stand up, and they have signs. Wave, make noise. So
you do that so well.
Right.
Do
the wave, that's make funny. Noise.
I am on a show about
he needs to be a double
dancers.
Girl, I'm telling you.
Listen,
right,
it can happen. Season two. Write me in, Michael Rooney. I will do the choreography. So one thing leads to another. I'm running along the sideline for our little section with this wave sign. They're doing the wave. Fast forward to the next week, we're playing against Columbia, not Columbia, Princeton, Ivy League. Apparently, the mascots talk. So this guy that got into a fight with the Princeton Tiger was suspended for the next game.
Right.
So it's just me. So I'm chilling in my bird costume. I got like 10-pound feet on, big brown beak. I can barely see. I'm like, you look through the beak, so like, you, it's terrible. A little kid who works, who, his parent runs sports marketing, is like, hey, you should fight the Columbia Lion. And I'm like, no. It didn't go well last week. He's like, no, really, you should fight the Columbia Lion. I was like, I'm not going over there. He said, but he's right behind you.
Oh my god!
And I turn around. No lie. Whoever played the Columbia Lion in 1999, get at me on Twitter because we got some problems. Yeah. So this dude doesn't have his lion's paws on. He has on football gloves and he's bopping up and down in a boxing stance. And like I'm like, oh man,
he's
it's really
ready.
He's ready.
Yeah. He's ready.
I'm like, I'm not ready. I got on heavy feet. I got like 4 foot of beak in front of me. So one thing leads to another. He swings at me, he misses. He swings at me, he hits me. I'm like, we can't hear each other. So I'm like gesturing with my wings, like, please, don't, like, stop, I don't want to fight. Next thing you know, he just, I'm from Brooklyn. You're only going to push me but so many times.
Okay.
So he threw his towel at my beak, and it missed. And when I went to pick it up, he bopped me on the head. And then it was over.
The rest is history.
I tackled him and put him in a headlock. My head pops off. We both get thrown out. Uh-huh. I come back out, and they're like, the whole stands are going nuts because now they know who's inside the mascot outfit. Next thing you know, I got tired of being the bird because people hated the Mountain Hawk. And
right.
The armband thing went so well that I decided to take the Ultimate Warrior thing all the way.
Oh.
So I put, like, I made a little pom-pom ponytail action with the armbands around the thing, and I became Wave Man, and I would run along 120 yards along the field with the crowd as they did the wave, and we tried to go as many times before I fell down. So for 3 years at Lehigh, that was really fun and really awesome. And
it made history.
Well, it'll never happen again.
Yeah. But
for those who witnessed it, it was something special.
That's hilarious. Okay, so we know that you not only went to your undergraduate institution, but you went on to get a master's degree in acting,
sure,
which is at Ohio University.
That's right.
Not the most common thing.
No.
Very cool. Tell us, do you feel like that made you more well-rounded as an actor in terms of getting that additional training?
Absolutely, without a doubt. If I had come out of school at Lehigh and just gone straight to like move to LA or whatever, it wouldn't have went well.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think, for any number of reasons. Mm-hmm. But going to grad school allowed me to grow up because you're in grad school from 22 to 25.
Yeah.
That helps a lot.
Yeah.
But
J. Cole said the same thing, by the way.
Who?
J. Cole.
Oh, yeah.
In a recent interview, he talked about, like, same thing, BAs in rapping world, not the most common. What advantage did it give you? And he said exactly what you said. It kind of gave him 4 years to enter the game at a different level.
Yes, absolutely. So by the time I came out, they taught us when we first got to my acting program, Jack Young, who's now at the University of Houston,
right.
He had said, this is a professional actor training program. So you're a professional actor from day one, right now. You have to think of yourself like that. And I did. While I was in school, I would do different projects. I shot independent film. I got my SAG card before I got out of grad school by doing a commercial in Cincinnati. So, I'm also classically trained. I can do the Shakespeare's. I can do, Ibsen and things from, the 1800s and such. So I wouldn't be able to do that as well without having gone to grad school. I also do voiceovers and blah, 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 and all that came from.
So speaking of Professor Young, he also said that if you just want to be a TV and film actor,
yes,
just go ahead, go in, go deep. But if you want to be full spectrum, as you were describing, broad spectrum actor, stay in this program.
Yeah.
Now, with that in mind, now that you're on hit television show, episodic, could you do Terrence the way you do Terrence without the training you got at Ohio University?
Absolutely not.
Got it.
No
okay.
way. So, no. Yeah. Okay. No. He. What he said was, after my first semester, he said, if you want to work in film and television, you have everything you need to go right now.
Right.
If you want a career in acting, mm-hmm. a career in the theater. I need you to give me 2 more years.
Right.
And I said, okay, fine. That's what I want. I want to be able to do everything.
Mm. Right.
So I stuck around, and I did that. And I came out, and I got my first gigs were in regional theater. I was doing August Wilson. And mm-hmm. then my first big job was on Broadway and, right. you know, understudying in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. And mm-hmm. I had a lot of my Broadway success way before any of this ever happened, before right. I did Bourne Legacy, before, you know, For Better or Worse and all these other TV shows mm-hmm. and now Hit the Floor.
Right.
So, I mean, they make fun of me for a lot of things on Hit the Floor, even like in episode 5 when I unveil the Yelena's restaurant,
uh-huh.
McKinley and Jonathan would not stop making fun of the way I took the curtain off of the thing.
So dramatic, right?
But it was that's part of it, you know,
right.
that's part of that. If you played the king of something and you had to do something with a flourish, I didn't plan it. I was just like, I'm the king. This is my restaurant. Boom, restaurant. Chick, take that. That's what I've been hiding. Like, you know what I mean? So I don't know how I would have done that, but I right. don't think it would have been the same way.
I hear what you're saying. It's yeah. like you internalize that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, with your master's degree, you've also taught acting
yes.
in the past.
Right.
Do you ever think that you would take a break from your acting career and go back to teaching?
Not on purpose.
That was so real.
No, you know, no. I mean, I love teaching. I love working with children. I love working with anybody. I love teaching acting, period. Like, if we were to do an acting workshop, it would undoubtedly go longer than you planned, because I'm going to find other things to work on mm-hmm. and try to tweak this and tweak that. Mm-hmm. I love it. It's something that I would like to do maybe once things slow down. Like, mm-hmm. if I end up being out here forever, then, you know, maybe take some type of residency at UCLA or USC and teach a workshop there, a master class, or you maybe have one class that I have to deal with. But, mm-hmm. You know, I'm in it right now. I've gotten the success as a performer since I've left grad school. So the teaching thing has taken a backseat. Having my master's allows me the ability to teach at any university in the country.
Yeah, okay.
And now that I have a career behind me, I really can teach at any university in the country mm-hmm. since that's the terminal degree in acting. Yeah. I ain't trying to pick up the old dry erase marker no time soon, girl.
Well, how important is it for you to mentor other aspiring actors?
I mean, it's incredibly important to me. I don't think that knowledge isn't worth anything unless you can give it to somebody,
mm-hmm.
you know, and you don't learn. There's a pyramid of learning, and I forget exactly how the diagram goes, but I think you retain 93% of what it is that you teach.
Yeah.
Like, it's like hearing it, reading it, writing it, and then teaching it. And if you teach it, you retain the most amount of it. So I'm a big proponent of that. If somebody asks me a question, I'll be the first one to tell you whatever I know. At the same time, I'm not going to say that's the only way to do it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
I'm telling you my version. This is how I did it. This is what I know not to do. Somebody else might have figured out another way, a better way, a quicker way. I don't know. But I will impart any knowledge that I have.
Yeah.
It's vastly important, whether they're, you know, somebody in like junior high school or some elementary school kid that's like, I want to be an actor. And I'm like, well, you need to learn how to talk. Like, we need things like that, you know what I mean? So
first things first.
Yeah, first things first. Pronounce your consonants. I love it. Whether it's teaching acting or just mentoring, period. It's
cool.
I wouldn't be where I am if I didn't have people do that for me. So,
yeah,
you know.
Now, also, before you really got into acting, you were doing real estate and you were doing mm-hmm. sales, right? And you were mm-hmm. squeezing in auditions and lunch breaks and everything. So your hustle was, you know, on a max 10.
Yes.
Right?
Hustle was on tilt.
Yeah. So what is your message for actors who feel they can just kind of skate by on good looks and their charm versus not have that hustle that you had?
Good luck. Good luck. It's not going to last forever.
Mm-hmm.
You can be successful in entertainment without being good at anything nowadays. So
mm-hmm.
there is that,
mm-hmm.
Especially with the advent of reality television and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
So if you want to do that, that's fine. You're entitled to that. There are a lot of people whose careers are built on the way they look. And for many of us, I don't think there's an actor in there who doesn't get their role based on how they look. That how they look doesn't necessarily mean they're smoking hot or whatever. They could be the round pudgy character or the nerdy character or the skinny girl or whatever it is. So, I mean, you know, more power to you, but at the same time, it's about what stories you want to tell. And if someone gives you a story that they want to have told and you want to help them tell it, then you better be able to do so. Otherwise, people are inevitably going to stop giving you that responsibility. That's what James, James LaRosa and all of the folks that wrote our show did, as far as I was concerned. They entrusted me with a story that they wrote and my ability to tell it to other people.
Yeah.
So I said, okay, well, I have the tools to do this. I'm going to do it to the best of my ability. Thankfully, you know, we're going to get a chance to do that for a second season. So apparently it's going well. A lot of people like the way we tell these stories and the stories themselves. But for folks that are just trying to get by on just that, you know, that cute factor, a little bit of cute and charisma, a lot of people move to Hollywood because they're cute and charismatic.
Right.
And then 10 years later, they're talking about how hard it is to be an actor.
Yeah.
Well, what did you do that gave you any idea or any thought that you could do this?
Yeah.
Aside from going, oh, that looks like fun, and or I kind of look like that person,
right.
Or I make people laugh in school. Like, there's more to it than that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, you know, hey, yeah. More power to you, but we'll yeah. see.
That makes perfect sense to me.
We'll
so with the plethora of formal training that you came to L.A. with,
yes.
you going back to finishing your graduate degree, one of your first big roles, the coveted role of understudy to Terrence Howard
yes.
in Cat in a Hot Tin Roof.
Oh, yeah.
That opportunity, I know, probably is just amazing, and it afforded you the space to work with the great James Earl Jones.
Oh.
Give us, I'm sure he just dropped wisdom, like, every day. Like, but what's, like, one of the best nuggets that he gave you?
You know, I don't know. I can't say he gave me a nugget of wisdom that I can encapsulate in, like, some awesome sound bite.
Okay.
But I will say that.
Damn it. No, I'm just kidding.
I know.
I'm just kidding.
I usually have sound bites in my pocket, like James said. I was very flattered by the fact that before we had ever, because I was the understudy and before I'd ever performed the role or he had ever rehearsed anything with me, he said that he was looking forward to seeing me perform as Brick.
Mm.
I played a servant in the house. This is the nugget he gave me without telling me anything. How about that?
Okay.
I was a servant in the house. All of the understudies, we filmed, filled out the servant cast. This is Cat on a Hot Tin Roof. Mm-hmm. The family is very wealthy. It's typically a white family, and they have black servants. So we filled out the house with the servants mm-hmm. when we were understudies, as opposed to just hanging out and waiting to get a call. I played a servant named Brighty, and I brought in the birthday cake for Big Daddy. In the second act, it's Big Daddy's birthday. That's why they're all there in the first place. So everybody comes in the Brick and Maggie's bedroom, and he brings in a big birthday cake. Second week of rehearsal, James Earl Jones is sitting there, and he goes, Rob. Okay. He goes, what's your character's name? I said, Brighty. And Brighty, he goes, okay, good. I just, you know, I think Big Daddy's a man of the earth. I feel like he would, you know, he knows all of the people that work in his house. So I just wanted to know your character's name. I said, okay, great. From that day forward, every rehearsal, every performance, when I walked in with that birthday cake and I sat it down in front of him, he would go, Brighty. No one would hear it.
Mm-hmm.
We were mic'd. No one could hear him say that. But the fact that he did that
yeah.
showed
yeah.
how intricately invested in mm-hmm. this performance that he was. This is not a line. This is not a response to someone's line. This is when everything else is going around in the show. This man is saluting his servant that brought out his birthday cake, who he's known for X amount of years because he hired him and they've been through this and blah, 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 blah.
Yeah.
Brighty. So you couple that with the fact that this 77-year-old man was the first person off book
mm-hmm.
out of everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I was second. He was the first person off book. You, those are the things that I picked up, that work ethic that a lot of people say, you know, theater actors have this incredible work ethic. Well, he's one of them, and he does. So if I can be him when I'm 77, turn up. I'll take that.
Let's turn up for James Earl. Absolutely.
For real.
Yeah.
Well, after Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, you went on to play Dave Robinson in Lombardi, also on Broadway. Your character was the first black linebacker in the NFL.
Yes.
How do you prepare for a role with such historical significance?
Well, the fact that Dave Robinson was the first, he was the first black middle linebacker, which is like the captain of the defense. And much like, unfortunately, well, not so much in the last 5 years, but previously, the stereotype was that black quarterbacks were not as bright as their white counterparts.
Certainly.
So, and it was the same school of thought for the linebacker, the person who's going to be running everything. So Dave Robinson was a very intelligent guy, came from Penn State, and what was more important about that was the fact that this man, Vince Lombardi, this white man in the late 50s and 60s, mm-hmm. was so progressive that he didn't care what anybody thought about anything. He didn't care about the color of your skin. He didn't care about any of that. He just wanted to win. Mm-hmm. And part of that came from him being, you know, treated poorly as a dark-skinned Italian mm-hmm. growing up in Brooklyn and blah, blah, blah. But there was a lot of reverence surrounding Lombardi and every aspect of that, because football's got that pageantry in America. And the fact that this man basically made the Super Bowl trophy is named after Vince Lombardi. Yeah. That's really all you need to know. Yeah. They could have named it after a lot of other people, but they named it after him. So, you know, it was great to be a part of. That's one of the best experiences of my life. The Green Bay Packers organization embraced us. The Packers fans embraced us. They would fly in from Wisconsin to come see the show. It was the longest running show on Broadway from the previous season. That wasn't a musical at one point. You know, I was a part of it for a year. Dan Laurier is now on Sullivan and Son. Chris Sullivan is still on Broadway. I don't know what show he's in right now. He was in Chicago for a while. Bill Dawes is a comedian. Judith Light won 2 Tonys after being nominated for I was surrounded by some folks. Some folks. Yes. So I've been fortunate in my career, and that experience is no exception at all.
Yeah. That's awesome. So now, before Robinson, right? You know, people like you said, people really felt that you know, black people, black athletes weren't smart enough, you know, to play these leading roles, you know, especially on the field. And so you had Doug Williams, who shattered that stereotype of being the first quarterback to win the Super Bowl, right? So, you know, yet there's still a lot of stereotypes. But like, how do you feel about that? You know, now, especially you say after the past five years, so how do you feel that has changed, especially in the sports industry?
I think it's changing. I think it's changing a little bit more rapidly than it has in the past. I think even when Donovan McNabb was a starter, he still had to deal with it. I think Culpepper still had to deal with it.
Mike Vick still dealt with it.
I think Michael Vick had to deal with it in the beginning of his career. I think that what's happening now is that the talent and the success is so great that it would do you no good to try to say that person is not intelligent, because they technically have to be intelligent in order to utilize their talent to gain that success.
Yeah.
So that's what's happening. You get RG3 that comes in, and they're putting up, and Cam Newton, and they're putting up monster numbers in college.
Yeah.
But they come in and they win immediately, and they make people look silly.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're crushing tons of other quarterbacks, black, white, or the other.
Yeah.
So you're... it's reaching a critical mass, so to speak, where you can say that, but you look really stupid.
And do you think, in that same vein, Rob, do you think that that's the same kind of formula that'll have to be utilized to change black progress off the field in terms of coaching and general managers and things of that nature? The Mike Tomlinsons, people like that, that are, you know, they're winning Super Bowls. So at some point, or at least getting to the Super Bowl, is that the same kind of formula?
I think that's going. I think it's yes. It has to follow the same formula. Okay. I think that is that process is much more retarded, as in late.
Slow. Yes.
Than the not retarded, but retarded.
Yeah, literally.
Than the athlete process, and that's And I think it's because it's closer to the top, and it deals more with power.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the quarterback is a very powerful position,
right?
But he's still a football player,
right? And now you're talking infrastructure.
You're talking about people that you know,
like front office and stuff like that.
You know, I would like to think that inevitably has to happen the same way it's happening on the field and on the court. It remains to be seen. Mm-hmm. I think the push against that will undoubtedly be greater than it was for the athletes, because even though the coaches are, you know, nowadays everybody's got a bigger spotlight on them because of social media and so on and so forth.
Yeah.
But I still think the coaches take somewhat of a back seat to the players, so that that problem can also sit in the back seat. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. They can keep it there. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it's like, yeah, yeah. Oh, the coach is in black. Look at that dunk. Oh, my God. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, yeah. Wow, touchdown. No, no, it doesn't matter that there aren't, the GMs are all white. It doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Like, you know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost distract, you know, in a way, not a negative way necessarily, but it serves to distract from that issue.
Absolutely. Yeah. Smoke and mirrors, baby.
I see you. Well, on a brighter note, congratulations on season two.
Turn up!
Hit the floor.
Season two.
Absolutely.
So exciting.
How did you feel when you got the announcement? And were you guys nervous going into that?
Well, of course, anybody who says they were nervous is completely full of something.
Right.
No, my best friend had happened to come out to visit for his birthday this weekend, and we were running around. And I was actually in Banana Republic buying some ties that were on sale.
Yes.
and I got a call from James, and he told me, you know, that we got picked up for season two. And it got to the point where my buddy was like, you need to sit down. Like, you don't even know what you're doing. I was talking to him. I was, like, trying to send an email. I had just met with a publicist. So I was trying to do that. And, like, like my knees were weak, so I inevitably had to. And it happened a couple times that day. I had to sit down, but it was. I mean, season one's great. You know, everybody. You know, a lot of shows have a season one. Not a lot of shows get a season two.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, so having a season two is a really big deal. Like that means something.
Yes,
you
it
know,
does.
So it's like when your show on Broadway goes past that first couple months and people are still coming. You're like, man, this is, I'm doing it. I'm doing it. You know? So I think I was overwhelmed for quite some time. I guess I might still be in that little riding high zone.
Well, it's well deserved. You guys should, should be.
I greatly appreciate that. Yeah. We're a good team, so I'm glad we get to play for another season.
There you go.
Well, you have a very strong athletic background, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
You starred in an athletic themed play. You now star as an athlete on a hit TV show. Mm-hmm. Everyone, you know the saying, art imitates life. Would you say that this applies to you?
I think the fact that I'm still shaped like an athlete helps.
Yes.
That's helped. My first Law and Order role was a professional football player on Law and Order Criminal Intent. I was accused of a crime, but I didn't commit it. Thankfully.
Yeah.
I think that it's, I also understand the attitude of an athlete. I've never really lost that. Because I came up in team sports or in football. Mm-hmm. I played football from the time I was 11 until my freshman year in college.
Mm-hmm.
I've never really lost sight of that. So when I look at an ensemble performance, whether it's a play or whether it's the show that we're doing, everybody has a role, but everybody does the role to the best of their ability, and that's how the team moves forward.
Okay.
So that's helped me understanding how athletes work. I know a couple and obviously was one for some time. I think that's helped, but it's really got more to do with the fact that I'm shaped like an athlete,
right,
and can speak words that people understand.
And well, my man.
Yes, and well. That's got nice.
A lot of teeth and tongue action
teeth
going
and
on.
Tongue.
Very good. So in Hit the Floor, you initially auditioned for the role of Derek.
Mm-hmm.
And talk to us a bit about what attracted you to that role initially, but then, you know, we now know that ultimately you became very comfortable and kind of excited to play Terrence because he's atypical from what we tend to see from our professional athletes.
Absolutely.
Kind of give us your thoughts on that.
Well, I used to be Derek, so.
Oh, shoot now.
No, I mean, look, Derek has fun. Derek has a lot of fun. It's just that fun comes with repercussions and it
right.
doesn't really amount to anything after a while. So, you know, you have that fun, but keep in mind that A, it can go horribly wrong at some point, and B, it really isn't creating anything aside from some problems and maybe babies you don't want.
Potential debt.
Hashtag Dwight Howard.
Right, quick, right?
Come on.
Babies
now.
Racked up so quick.
For real.
Anyways.
Get it together, son.
That's why you left LA.
That's
exactly. Hey, listen, he's in Texas. No state income tax.
Yeah.
Need that money. I think Derek was a fun role, and I hadn't read the entire pilot when I auditioned for Derek, and the scenes were the. Where he bumps in her in the parking lot.
Yeah,
it's like cold shower for me then. Blah, blah, blah. sexy time.
So
I enjoyed that. It would have been fun. It was you know, I was looking forward to it. But I was actually in Atlanta shooting Single Ladies when I auditioned for Derek. And then I flew back to Los Angeles, and they called me in for Terrence. And I read Terrence, and I was just like, in the pilot, there wasn't a big difference between the two of them. There was the guy, the new guy, and then the guy who's been there, and the guy who doesn't have a girl, and the guy that does. And, you know, so it was... At first, it was like, all right, cool. I'm playing the other guy. No big deal. I'll take that. Yeah. But as the scripts started to come out, and as you know, we started to hear a little bit about what might be going on for the season, it became apparent to me that, you know, I was playing the
anti-Derek,
the adult,
kind
of. I was playing the grown up, and then there was, you know, the perpetual boy, which is basically what, you know, unfortunately a lot of young men are, especially athletes in their 20s, because, you know, you get a whole bunch of money when you're really young, and nobody to tell you anything else to do. You know, if you're not playing sports, you're hanging out for the most part. So I'm a big proponent or big supporter of the fact that of highlighting the fact that athletes do good things, that all athletes aren't terrible people, that especially because the majority of professional athletes that are in the spotlight are black men.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I take it personally when the stereotype is that they're going to jail and that they're making it rain and that they got baby mamas and that they, you know, so on and so on.
Some of them are abusive.
And that they're abusive and all these other things. So it's the fact that, and who knows where Terrence is going in season two, I don't know, but I think once you turn your back on that crazy stuff, you can't really look at it the same way as like, you know. So I was really proud of the fact that Terrence had his girlfriend, and he was obviously, or at least apparently, faithful to her, and was focused on things that mattered, starting businesses, you know, building towards the future, trying to win championships, things that are important. And, you know, I, as I've said before, I said this in AfterBuzz, you're more likely to hear about an athlete's, you know, getting in a domestic violence altercation or making it rain in a strip club or anything like that than you are to hear that Kevin Durant took $1 million out of his charity and donated it to the victims of the tornado in Oklahoma City.
Yeah.
So it's, I think that stuff needs to be highlighted more. I think if you highlight that, it helps everybody.
Yeah.
It helps everybody because it helps the kids that look at those athletes to then say, oh, well, this is what I'm supposed to do when I get there, as opposed to I'm supposed to buy 16 chains, 3 cars, 2 homes, and surround myself with chicks.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It we don't. So I like the fact that, at least for right now, Terrence is that guy. He's representative of many of the professional athletes and entertainers that I know who are out there doing what you're supposed to do when you're afforded that stage and freedom, which is really what money can buy you.
So. Yeah, we love that too. And as you said, very, very underrepresented in fictional media, but also, you know, real life media for sure. But are you still having fun with Terrence? I mean, even though,
I'm having all kinds of fun.
Good.
Well, yeah, I mean, look, it's fun to buy your lady a restaurant. I'd buy my lady a restaurant if I could. Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
I'm like, oh, you're so mad. Blah, blah, blah. Yeah, wait till tomorrow. Oh, I'll be there tomorrow. Yeah, boom, restaurant, take that. You know what I mean? Like, hashtag winning, like, you know what I mean? Like, I'm good.
Yeah.
I love it. It's you know, we're in, we got episode 9 and 10 coming up, so things are getting a little sticky.
Hopefully more basketball playing on screen.
Season 2, baby.
Okay.
Season 2.
Which NBA player do you model Terrence after?
I think in the dynamic of the relationship, it's Dwayne Wade and LeBron James in their first season together, Terrence and Derek, respectively. I think in terms of attitude, what I glean from Kobe Bryant is what I try to infuse Terrence with, which is, first of all, I'm the man. Second of all, you know what I mean? Like, stats, schmats, I'm the man. You know it. It doesn't matter. I'm trying to win a championship, get it together. As a matter of fact, anything that's not concerned with my championship aspirations, means nothing to me. Mm-hmm. So I don't care what's going on with the Devil Girls. I don't care what's going on. Look, if you get to practice, Derek, I don't care how many chicks are in the bed. That's nice. Get up and get to practice. I'll do whatever it takes to win the championship to the point where, okay, this isn't working out. I'm going to go get traded. You got to understand, my eye's on the prize. Like, I'm focused. Yeah. And I feel like that's the mode that Kobe's been in since, you know, Shaq left. Or, well, since things fell apart after Shaq left, and he spent those 2 years of shenanigans. And then it came
finding himself.
Shenanigans. Oh, is that what we're calling that, Nick?
Good word.
That's funny. Okay.
We're going to call it shenanigans. In lieu of many other things. But no, I feel like that's where he is now. I think that even that was, you know, Dwight Howard might not have liked what Kobe had to say, and of course Kobe may have been able to phrase that a little bit better, but it's like, I'm going to teach you how to win I got five. I'll teach you how to win championship, son. Like, but you know, so I like 24 Kobe better than 8 Kobe. 8 Kobe was a little different. So I'm the 24 Kobe. I'm the new Kobe. Terrence is the new Kobe.
Got it. So we know that Terrence is not only just a fantastic, you know, ball player, a devoted boyfriend, he's also a very savvy businessman, as you pointed out. Yeah. If Rob Riley had to open a business tomorrow, what would it be?
I would undoubtedly open a restaurant.
Really? Do you cook?
I do.
Okay.
I do. Right. Plus, it's the whole Caribbean thing. Yeah, our cuisine is delicious, and you don't find it very many places, especially out here. Mm. Back home in New York and Brooklyn, I can get it everywhere. Mm. So I would open up. I've always wanted to have a restaurant or a place where everyone that I know could gather and have fun. Like, I like being the facilitator of fun, if I can be. So if I have an establishment, we can come, eat, listen to some good music, you know, maybe even have a little lounge action, because you know that some dancing will happen.
Right.
So have a little, you know, hook it up like STK, where you can have a little lounge action in the middle, off to the side, and then you've got your sit-down dinner aspect of it.
Very cool. Well, I support that. I like that notion. Because I just don't think there's enough, like, really cool, loungy, grown, and sexy places
in
L.A.
There's so few of them.
There's too few.
So
where
few.
The young professionals can just kind of go.
Get together.
Eat,
right.
Have a nice cocktail.
Yeah.
No one's too...
When you're not trying to turn up.
Not too turned up. Yeah. It's a little too much someplace.
You gotta meter out the turning up of things. If you turn up too much, you burn out.
Yeah, I totally agree.
That's
totally.
True.
Yeah, you don't want to flame out on the turn up.
So now, let's talk about you giving back. Because we know that you're actively involved with a nonprofit organization. It's the Men of Color in the Industry.
Mokiti,
right? So what prompted you to give back in this particular way?
Well, when I first got here, I was looking for a little bit of a network. I wanted to find folks that were doing something positive. I ran into a guy named Ren T. Brown, who runs the the Negro Ensemble Theater Company down at the Nate Holden Center on 4718 West Washington. And he was going to speak at this group, and it happened to be Mokiti. He had never really heard of it or hadn't been there yet. So I went. It's about 3 years old. It's founded by John Covington. And so I went, and I liked what they had to say. And the thing I took the most note of was that they went to MLK Elementary and mentored the kids. And they go every Friday for an hour, every Friday of the year, and mentor these young men, 25 to 30 third, fourth, and fifth graders, to just show them positive role models of you know, men of color that are doing things. And we're not all actors. Some of us are writers and musicians and entertainment lawyers and, you know, all aspects of the entertainment industry. It's literally men of color in the industry. Mm-hmm. But we're going back and giving back to kids that look like us, you know. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've done in any theater I've ever been to. Every city that I've made a stop in, I've done that. I've been in the theater. I'll go to the education department and be like, whatever it is going on while I'm here, let me know. And if you think I can help, then I'll go do it, whether it's been in Cincinnati or in Connecticut or in Texas or in Portland or wherever it is. I've done that. And in Baltimore, and I got my start at Lehigh with Jenny Gilrain and Mark McKenna at the who were at the Touchstone Theater at that point. We did a Building Bridges program. We went to into the schools in the Lehigh Valley and dealt with at-risk youth and taught them interpersonal communication through theater games. So these are the kids that are on their way out. This is their last stop before they get kicked out of school altogether. And you know, some of them are on medication. Some of them just have behavioral problems, and teaching them how to interact with one another. And you know, there was a game called Agree to Disagree, which sounds like something we say all the time, like let's agree to disagree. But little kids need to know how to do that. You need to know how to do that so that you don't get into a fight, so that you can understand I have my point of view, you have your point of view, you're in the middle, and we all get to say what we have to say, and then it's over.
You know, that's so funny you say that, Rob, because it's so simplistic when you explain it like that, but I can't even imagine the difference we would see in the way, the behavior of students if something like that was implemented in curriculum.
Well, I mean, you...
Right? I mean, just think about that. I mean, how many less suspensions there would be? How many less school fights there would be?
The problem is it doesn't happen until you
it's too late.
Yeah, you get those crisis counselors. You know, that happens after the fight, and then you have to go sit down with somebody, and they're going to talk about it. Well, if you had, you know, the prevention is always better than the cure. So if you get in there early and you can teach them, then that helps. So that's what, in all of the programs that I had been in around the country, I was going in after there was a problem. Granted, we're in the worst school in the LA Unified School District, but we're getting in there before there's too much of a problem. These kids are third, fourth, and fifth grade. So I can tell you, first of all, you can get as angry as you want with me, little third grader. You understand nothing's going down. You know, and I'm usually the enforcer there because I'm one of the bigger dudes, and I have a very loud voice, and I don't take crap from anybody, especially a little child. And and they, so I'm that person. But they also understand that if you do that from a place of wanting their best interest, little kids get that immediately. You can be as hard on them as you want. If they know that you're doing that because you care, they're all for it. They are all for it. So Mokiti's and their mentoring program at MLK Elementary, Principal Bell is the principal over there. You know, sometimes we'll take them on field trips, but a lot of it is just spending that hour a week and them looking forward to us coming there. And, you know, some of them don't have the best family structures. Many of them are growing up without fathers. So to have an adult male show up and care about how they do in school and care about them not getting in trouble and care about them being there on time and care that their grades went up from one week to the next. Like that, there was this one kid, little Jason. It was one day, it's the very beginning of the school year last year, he told me he wasn't good at math. And I'm like, well, how could you not be good at math? You're in third grade. That doesn't even make sense. Like, you have to, let's figure out why you're not good at math. He goes, okay. Well, I said, can you count? Yeah, I can count. I said, well, math is important, man. How are you going to know how to get your change from the store when you buy your chips or your ice cream or whatever? He was like, well, I said, so can you, do you buy stuff? Yeah. Well, then you can count. Well, okay. Well, how many quarters are in a dollar? Four. Okay, well, then how many dimes in, you know, what does it take to get to a quarter? Well, two dimes and a nickel. Okay, so how many dimes are in a dollar? Well, there are 10. And we go through all of this stuff, and by the end of it, he can tell me it takes 20 dimes, you know, and 10 nickels to make 250, and I need that to go to the ice cream store to get that thing. The next week, the kid comes back, and he's like, Mr. Rob. I'm like, what's up, Jay? What's up? He's like, I got a 13 on my quiz, and I'm like, I'm thinking, oh, 13. 13. What was your grade last week?
13%.
Jeez.
He's like, but it's up from a 7. So it's
so.
But it was 13 out of 13.
Oh, wow.
So the kid, I mean, he literally needed, it was just a connecting of the dots. I didn't teach him anything. I didn't teach him how to count. He knew how to count. He knew how to count 10, which meant he knew to get from 10 to a dollar, which means you can count tens into 100 and to 1,000, which is $10, and so on and so forth. So just little things like that. Like somebody's got to do that for every kid. And you know, if you can help doing that and you don't, well then you're kind of
a shitty
person.
I agree. Shame
lazy and selfish.
Well, in the wake of the Trayvon Martin case,
let's go.
Many felt that Trayvon was profiled and ultimately killed because he was seen as suspicious. Tell us what it feels like for you living as a black man in this type of climate.
Where just your pure blackness in and of itself is almost suspicious by definition. What is
that
like?
Well, I grew up in Flatbush, Brooklyn, New York. So it's something I'm very accustomed to. Although where I was... in Brooklyn, it was interesting because the white people would cross the street when they saw me, whereas down south back in the day was the other way around.
Oh, well, we would cross the street when
right.
we saw them
coming. Right, you saw a group of white people, you might need to be on your P's and Q's, whereas in my neighborhood, it was flip-flop, so we would walk around like, you know, it's that get off my block mentality. Once you get into Manhattan, that changes a little bit if you're in Midtown or, you know, if you're not in Harlem or on the Lower East Side or one of the more minority-centered neighborhoods. So you got to see both sides of the coin. I was in a lot of gifted programs, so a lot of times I was one of the few black students in my class. I told you that's the way it was when I went to Lehigh. It was 93% white when I was there. I actually wrote a play with Kashi Johnson at Lehigh as a result of a racial incident on campus there, which brought to light in 2001 that there was still vehement racism existing among educated young adults.
Can you just give us just a tiny bit? I know we don't have a ton of time.
Well, what happened was there weren't a lot of black fraternities on campus, as can be expected, because it's predominantly white. A couple of black fraternities, one in particular, had just come back, Kappa Psi.
Shout out to the Noops.
Yes, Noops. they had a little bit of a presence on campus. There was a big event where all the fraternities and sororities got together, as you can imagine, in a big arena with all of the fraternities and this one black fraternity there and sororities. It's really easy to spot who's who.
Right.
There was a black guy talking to a white girl. At this point, the internet wasn't super crazy, but we did have electronic message boards. The school had one called the Daily Jolt. People took to that message board to voice their displeasure with seeing this black student talk to this this black man talk to this white woman. It got ugly really fast, and it got as old school as people writing "All Niggers Must Die." So we wrote a play in response to that. A lot of people were up in arms. You know, people thought about fighting and marching and blah blah blah. And what inevitably happened is, as a suggestion from somebody who was eavesdropping on a conversation of mine, I went to Kashi. She had a slot for a one woman show at the theater. We did a two-handed show instead of that called Untold Truths, and the subtitle was Why We Always Sit Together. And as you notice,
we self-segregate.
Every culture does it. Sometimes it happens, and, you know, the athletes sit here and blah, 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 whatever it is. So I say all that to say that I know in my mind what happened with the Trayvon Martin case. I could see how he could have even been somewhat culpable because you don't like being profiled. I would have been upset as a 17-year-old if somebody was profiling me, and I might not have been the nicest person in the world. I don't think in any way, shape, or form that he deserved to die.
Right.
I think that it's very easy to bang your head against the concrete and make it look like somebody else did it, especially if your life is on the line. I think that the prosecution lost the case because an overwhelming majority of decision makers in America still have old ideals. I think that the general population is moving in the right direction, and I will call it the right direction without any equivocation, towards equality and peace and harmony. But there are still people that are in very powerful positions that make it difficult for this shift to happen as quickly and fully as we would like to. So until those people die,
right,
which is inevitably what will probably have to happen, the old guard will have to go away, and then there will be less people that have been taught that in the new guard, and then progressively less and progressively less.
So basically just kind of breed out the hate.
That's the only thing I think I can hope for, because you can only teach but so much. They say a man's teacher arrives precisely at the moment at which he is ready to learn. So you can talk to somebody till you're blue in the face.
Right.
If they're not willing to listen or ready to learn, it doesn't matter. So if I'm racist, You can tell me all the facts that mean that I shouldn't be racist. If I want to be racist, mm-hmm. I'm going to be racist. Yeah. Right. And same thing with homophobic, right. same thing with sexist. You can get all the facts in the world that make you look ridiculous.
Right. Yeah.
If you're not ready to turn the page, mm-hmm. then you're not. And some of those people are holding on to ideals where they feel like their whole world would crumble
yeah.
if
yeah.
they were to give those up.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
if your whole life is based in the church and then somebody tells you that what the church said is not necessarily correct, you might be like, well, I can't give that up yeah. because I need to hold on. Like, this is the church is all I know.
Shakes yeah. your foundation.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And who wants a shaky foundation?
Yeah.
So.
Well, that is fantastic. That's a fantastic response. I think it says a lot. It's a lot of layers in there. And I agree with you that when people just are intrinsically feeling that people are devalued, which is what I think a lot of what's going on with this whole notion of blackness equating to be suspicion. It's just a devaluing of life for a particular segment of people, particularly black men. And Nick, if you want to speak to this, please do. I agree with you. I don't know how to decode that, so to speak. You know, how do you deprogram that type of ridiculous, unfounded thinking? Because like you said, we can have all the conversations about how ridiculous, how unwarranted, how unfounded, how factually you have nothing to support it. But when there's a segment of people that yeah. just intrinsically believe it.
What I think it is probably, I think that as a black man or in the black community, what we need to do first is we need to hold ourselves to a higher standard.
I agree completely.
Know? And because what it is too is like people see us how we see ourselves. And so since, you know, like there's black on black crime here, Chicago, this and that, you know what I mean? So like, so they already feel that our value isn't as high as their value.
Uh-huh.
And because we don't put our value as high as their value.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean? Uh-huh. So like as a people to come together, like we have to be like, okay, like, you know, we are not equal, but better. You know what I mean? Like we're, uh-huh.
Yeah.
And not even essentially better, but we're like,
no,
it's all the same playing field. Like I bleed just like how you bleed. You know what I mean? And so like at the end of the day, until people, you know, until the other cultures, I'll say,
right.
can see us, you know, how we should really see ourselves.
Right.
Then it's not going to change.
No, at the same time, that perception has been systematically implemented so that it's been bred from one generation to the next
right.
from a long time ago that the value isn't there.
Yeah.
So the way I bust that stereotype is by opening my mouth mm-hmm. because you can say whatever you want. I'm from Flatbush, Brooklyn. I am black. I am Caribbean. Mm-hmm. I was raised in a single-parent household. I kicked crack vials off of a courtyard and shot basketballs at a milk crate that was nailed up, that was tacked to a boarded-up window. When I was a kid, like I took public transportation to school, like I went to public schools. I've got a degree from Lehigh University. I've got a Master's of Fine Arts in Acting from Ohio University. Mm-hmm. I've been classically trained. I've been on Broadway twice. I've been off Broadway. Like, you can say whatever you want, but when you look at the little me on the street, right. you have to acknowledge that I'm the big me came from that little
you
me.
You can never discredit your experience.
Absolutely
not. And I love that, and I think that you're right. The more all of us share our stories, perhaps that's a small beginning of people just starting to get a context. Because I feel like as black people, often we're seen out of context.
Well, we are. And we also, as men, there's this hyper-masculinity that is, I mean, I don't know. I was born in 1980. I don't know how it was in the 70s. I know in the 80s it was, you know, everything was a little weird. And then in the 90s we had, you know, rap hip-hop really exploded and kind of took hold. And everything was gangster. But now it's like, it's all about, you know, making it rain and blah, 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 and shenanigans. It's if we were to understand that is entertainment. Right. It's like when I was a little kid, my grandmother used to tell me that the people that were wrestling on the television, that's make-believe. If you did that to your brother, he's going to die. Like, you're going to hurt your brother. You guys can't do that.
That's not real. But see, the problem, though, Rob, is that so too few black children have someone to distinguish that for
exactly.
them.
Exactly.
And put that, because I can listen as an educated, you know, I have a JD, I practiced law for 8 years, all this stuff. I can listen to 2 Chainz ridiculousness
or
somebody talking about popping a Molly and know, illegal to slip a narcotic into someone's drink then gang rape them against their force.
You don't even know.
right. But everyone doesn't have that context. And unfortunately, it's under my belief that the cost is too high.
I agree.
That we have been irresponsible.
I agree.
As a community in the way that we distribute that type of music and imagery. And for me, it's time to cut it out.
I think people, what has to happen is the artist has to say, they have to come out and say, I was kidding.
But they're not. But some of them are kidding. When you got, what's your boy, this Instagramming scissor. I know. You know what I'm talking about.
Who, Lil Wayne?
Wayne and then the other ridiculous one.
Yeah, you got Drake, y'all.
Drake.
All
but,
yeah. Yeah, so I don't know. But take anyways, we'll be here all day. But maybe we can reconvene as the Black Summit Council.
Listen,
all
right, y'all need, you need that, BET.
Yeah, y'all
you
do.
Need that.
Yeah, you do. Seriously.
For real.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
what is some real quick? When asked, what advice would you give your 20-year-old self? You told the story about being in a club and standing on a sofa, you know, popping bottles next to LeBron.
Yeah.
Right? And so then you thought that was important and cool. But now, not so cool.
Yeah.
Right? So how important was going through that type of behavior in getting you to a place of solid maturity and growth, you know, that you have arrived at?
I think it was greatly important just because if you haven't lived it, you might be enticed by it, especially when you get close to it as a celebrity. I was doing that as a regular dude who just had some money and, you know, knew the guy at the door so I could get in with all my people, and we'd spend our hard-earned money on a bottle of alcohol that was
overly priced,
300% or 400% markup from what it's supposed to cost in the store. As we said before, I'm listening to the music like everybody else. So I'm saying to myself that, this is what's important. I got to do this. And now I made it. And then, you know, you hustling the next week to try and make that money back because you don't waste it. You know, you wasted $800 in a nightclub on two bottles of alcohol. Yeah. So it was really important for me. I wouldn't trade those times for anything because it allows me to just chill now. You know what I mean? I love it.
Okay, cool. Well, last we checked, it was easy for you to stay focused on, or easier, I should say, for you to stay focused on a set with such dazzling beauties because you had your own very special, wonderful lady.
Yes.
Tell us how that's going and how difficult it is to balance. We all know it's hard to balance relationship with any professional life.
Yes.
I can't even imagine what it's like with your particular chosen profession. Tell us about how you do that.
It is difficult. It is very difficult. Yeah. I will not get into too many specifics.
Totally fine.
But it is it's difficult. But you just got to, at the end of the day, you just got to try. You know, you got to try and hope for the best. I love my job, and I do work with any 14 beautiful women who are scantily clad most of the time when I see
them.
You
have a great job.
I do. I love my job. I'm also a professional, so, you know, I've come from the theater world. I've been a model. I've been next to people that are half naked that, you know, we were just changing clothes because we got to get ready to go do this thing. So for some people, it can be a little bit hard to understand how you could be in a bed with somebody that's so attractive and you know, not get your rocks off or not be, you know, trying to do that for your own personal gratitude. But if you're focused on telling the story, then you still have to tell the story. You know, the story doesn't say do what you want to do. The story says do what the character wants to do, which might not be what you want to do. So it's still easy to stay focused. It would be easy to be focused even if I did not have a girlfriend. I do. So that makes it easier for me to not have a wandering eye, so to speak. But no, it's the beauty of our show is that everybody is really tight. We've got a nice, it's really like a tight team. So,
awesome.
And Nick's been out with us before, so he sees we definitely,
it's like a family. I've been
family.
Really like a family.
Yeah, that's probably why you guys will have longevity that some shows don't.
From your mouth to God's ears, girl.
All right, so now we're gonna have fun.
Fun time.
We're gonna play a game. It's called the crossover.
Oh man, I thought it was called turn up. That's okay.
No,
turn up.
You are so silly. All right, so you're gonna play it with my two co-hosts.
Okay.
So this is the game. I'm going to give you guys some basketball players, professional and former or current NBA players, who have also parlayed their on-the-court talent to that of on-screen talent.
So we use that second talent loosely.
Right. So maybe I should say on-screen appearances.
Yeah.
Okay. So then it's going to be a race for you guys. Once I say the name, you guys have to race to tell me the at least one prominent role and, you know, film or television show that the person comes from.
Okay.
All right, production crew, are you ready?
The
give me some music.
And the TV show. Okay.
Yep.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Okay.
Let's do it.
All right, can I get some Jeopardy music?
I'm a great competitor.
I'm focused.
Yep.
Focused.
Excellent. First up, Ray Allen.
Jesus Shuttlesworth.
He got game.
Oh, he got game.
Well, you kind of beat him, though. Yeah, you did say the next character.
Yeah. Jesus Shuttlesworth.
All right, so we got one for Rob. Next up, Michael Jordan.
Space Jam, Chicago Bulls.
Dang.
Get it together.
Okay, all right. So I'm going to take several different answers for this next one because he's done a lot.
Okay.
Rick Fox.
Hit the floor.
The game.
All right, Jessica kind of edged you out.
I did.
The game.
I totally did.
I mean, that counts too, but it's a race, and Jessica won.
And I believe
slow.
He was so also in Oz.
Sorry.
He's been like in everything. It's amazing. Yeah. He's really talented.
He's playing jailhouse basketball in Oz.
He was in Oz. I remember that. Shout out to Adebici. Yeah. Okay, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Lakers and wasn't it House of, what is it, House of Death? Game of Death?
Game of Death.
Yes, that's
the it's a martial arts film. Yeah,
he was a giant at the top, Bruce Lee.
Yeah.
I have a jacket from that movie.
That's good. All right. We got two more. Shaquille O'Neal.
Kazam.
Yeah, Nick got that.
There you go. Easy.
I have to get one. Yeah.
Nick's on the board. All right. All right. Last but not least, Dennis Rodman.
Double trouble, double take, double dragon.
Almost.
It's dragon. It's something. It's
different things. It's, you already got it wrong.
Bulls. He was on the Bulls. He was on
double.
Carmen Electra.
Oh man.
You guys all got it wrong. Yeah. Double team.
Double team.
I knew it was. I should get half for that.
All right. First of all, who else was in that movie?
John Claude Van Damme.
Who?
Jean-Claude Van Damme.
So the winner,
well,
of course.
No disrespect, Jean-Claude, but that was a terrible movie.
Rob spanked you guys' butt with that one. So
at least I got one.
You did. You get on the board. All right. So as we wrap up, we know that we can expect to see you in season two of Hit the Floor.
Yes.
What else can we expect to see?
Nothing else is on the docket right now. Okay. I'm working on some music, and finished a screenplay for a short film that I will hopefully be able to produce at the end of the summer here. But, we got two episodes left to hit the floor.
Excellent.
And then thankfully we'll be coming back for season two.
Awesome.
More LA Devils. Terrence Wall, turn up.
Where can people find you on social media, Terrence? Rob?
Oh, Terrence. Yeah. Rob.
You're that good.
Call me whatever you want. Just call me.
You're that good.
Call me.
All right.
Rob Riley, NYC, Instagram, Twitter,
awesome.
All that. Yeah.
Awesome. And you can find more of us. I am at @Ebony_K.
I am Jessica King.
Find me all over the internet at the Nick Perdue.
and he means all over the internet.
Right. Thanks so much for tuning in, guys. This is us at Black Hollywood Live next.
From producers Maria Menounos, Kevin Undergaro, Phil Svitek, Dario Kristen, and the entire BHL staff, we would like to thank you for tuning in to the Black Hollywood Live Network. If you have questions or comments, tweet us at BHL Online or email us at info@blackhollywoodlive.com. For more exclusive content, visit blackhollywoodlive.com. This has been a presentation of the Black Hollywood Live Network.
Hollywood redefined.
The views expressed here are those of the hosts only and do not necessarily reflect the views of BHL or its owners or principals.